Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judakin. In fall 2009, the Marcus Orr Center for the Humanities at University of Memphis hosted the 25th anniversary of the North American Sartre Society, bringing in more than 60 scholars from around the world to discuss one of the giants of 20th century intellectual life. One of the keynote speakers for the conference was Annie Cohen-Solal, author of an international best-selling biography of Sartre. In addition to several books on Sartre, she has also published books on Paul Nizan, on American painting, and most recently on the art dealer Leo Castelli. Annie Cohen-Solal is currently professeur des universités en délégation at the Centre National de la Recherche Scientifique Paris and research fellow at Tisch School of the Arts, New York University. She first came to New York in 1989 as the cultural counselor to the French embassy in the United States. Annie, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Annie, when you first learned about the conference in Memphis in the wake of President Obama's election, it was important for you to come here. Why were you so passionate about speaking about Sartre here in Memphis at this juncture in American history?
Because for us French people, Memphis is Martin Luther King. The date of April 4th, 1968, and this assassination on room 306 of the Lorraine Motel. This is a very, very strong image for the French in memory. And this is also, you know, a memory, a tragic memory, with whom we associate the name of Sartre. You know, and the fact that you celebrated this 25th anniversary of the Sartre, North American Sartre Society, with the keynote lectures in the Civil Rights Museum, I thought it was an incredible gesture. That's the reason why, you know, I was prompted to come. I must tell you that not only am I the Sartre, one of the Sartre biographers, but also when I was cultural counselor at the French embassy, the first element of my policy was to work on the French and the African-American community. And I came to take my position just a few days after Mayor Dinkins had been elected as first African-American mayor of New York City. And when the French Minister of Culture, Jacques Lang, came to New York, the first place I showed him was Harlem. So I think because the memory of African-American artists is very, very strong in France, you know that another element when I was at the embassy, one of maybe the most moving moments for me, when Miles Davis passed away. It was October 1991, and I was asked to speak at his funeral service at St. Peter's Church as a representative of the French government. And in this community of African-Americans, extremely elegant, extremely sensitive, what I said, I spoke after Bill Cosby and before Jesse Jackson, the thing I said is, the cover of Libération today, this daily paper today, it's a huge photo of Miles Davis. And the title was The Prince of All Jazz, I mean, died today. His name was Miles Davis. And I had noticed that in the New York Times, the death of Miles Davis was not on the first page. And I recalled what Miles Davis had written in his autobiography, which was when I went to Paris for the first time in 1946, I understand for the first time in my life what it was to be treated as a human being. So Sartre is maybe the first intellectual who denounced racial discrimination in the United States so strongly when he had a chance to travel to the country in 1945 and 1946. And by the same token, it was a trip which produced his first ethical engagement, commitment. This writer, this man, was 40 years old. He had never been really involved in political fights. He had never voted. He didn't even vote in the 1930s, where everybody was voting for the Popular Front. But it is his trip to the United States which really transformed him drastically. And it is these travels through the southern states of the United States which produced his stepping for the African-American community. So when you decided to celebrate the 25th anniversary of this society, Sartre Study Society, in Memphis and in the Civil Rights Museum, I thought it was an incredibly symbolic gesture because it was reuniting Martin Luther King's assassination with Sartre's gesture to stand up for the African-American community. Furthermore, it was in November 2009, not even a year after President Obama had been elected as the first African-American president in the United States. And I thought that it was another reason to come, because Sartre had predicted something absolutely fascinating when he came back from the U.S. in 1946. He had said, the United States is a democratic country, although it's a racist country. But I predict that this country would find a way to overcome the racism because of its democratic values. And the day will come when they would have African-American professors to lead the way. So as early as 1945 or 1946, not only did Sartre, you know, denounced racial discrimination in very, very strong and beautiful texts, but he also predicted that this country would be able to elect an African-American president.
And I'm going to come back to that moment, 1945, 1946, and to Sartre's understanding of America more generally. But before I do, let's just backtrack a little bit and create a portrait of Sartre. Let's talk a little bit about how Sartre was raised from birth to become a great intellectual. In fact, in your biography, you call the section describing his early years the march towards genius. Tell us about his upbringing in the Schweitzer family, his early years, and his education.
He's a child whose father passed away when he was 11 months old. He was raised by his mother, single mother, widowed mother, who lived with her own parents. So he was raised by a woman who created with him a couple. It was the mother-son couple until he was 11 years old, when she remarries. This very strong bond between mother and son is the basis. The second element is that the mother goes back to live with her own parents, who are Charles Schweitzer and his wife. Charles Schweitzer is a very interesting character. The man is a Protestant priest who could not follow up with his vocation because he was in love with a woman. And anyway, so he became a professor, following in the tradition of the family, which were great educators from centuries and centuries of great educators from Germany. And what he did was creating a very progressive method to teach German in France. Not only that, but he also, as a Protestant educator, he had created this attitude as opposed to the Catholic tradition of education. The Catholic tradition was very much pyramidal, hierarchical, where you tell the kid what to do and to mimic his masters. The Protestant tradition is all the opposite. It's not about repeating. It's not about learning by heart. It's about creating individualities, letting an individual blossom. So Charles Schweitzer, Sartre's grandfather, was one of the key educators who was around the Minister of Education, Jules Ferry, when he created the laic tradition of teaching in France in 1905, the year of the separation between state and church.
Laic, the secular tradition in France.
A very, very important date. So around this man was a team of Protestant pedagogues, among them Charles Schweitzer, Sartre's own grandfather. What happened in this family, in this little micro society, was that there was a link between mother and son, and around that, the grandfather. Sartre, as a young boy, was homeschooled until the age of 11 by his grandfather, who really was his single teacher. And I discovered letters from the grandfather talking about the intelligence of his grandson and his talent and so on. So basically you get a little kid under the adoring gaze of his mother and under the extraordinary authority of the grandfather, for whom he is the only child and the only student. So this double relationship will create this little boy with an absolute talent, genius in a way. And as you know, his autobiography called Les Mots was published in 1964, and it's built in two parts, first reading and then writing. And you really realize that he is almost pathologically intelligent. He says, because it's as if he was engendering himself through words and through writing, as if he was giving himself a second birth through literature. So he was writing little texts, you know, which were nothing special, but that the mother would copy and read and distribute around her. Then he would play his little plays in the Jardin du Luxembourg around the little girls. So very early on, he practiced what he will do later, which is, you know, seducing his lovers through his plays. All in all, you have encapsulated within these 11 first years of his life the tension and the, what I call actually, the toute puissance, the all-powerness of the man. In fact, there's a beautiful poem that he wrote at the age of 19 saying, "I am a little boy who doesn't want to grow up." I think this genius, this Sartre's genius, and the fact that he will become the first global intellectual comes from that moment where he feels that he is able to reach out. And at the age of 20, he'll do the same thing with, as a tool, the philosophical knowledge. One of the excerpts I put at the beginning of my big book is, "It is the whole world that I wish to possess," through actually the philosophical tool. So you understand that without the barrier of a father, there is this potential. And I even asked one of the very close friend of Sartre, who is the father of psychoanalysis in France, Jean-Bertrand Pontalis. I asked him one day, you know, he said, "Good luck for this biography one day." And I said, "Why are you so ironic?" He said, "Because it's very hard to grab Sartre, to manage to grab him." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because I met a lot of megalomaniacs in my life, but he's the only one with whom it worked. Megalomania, you know, worked out."
If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. With me today is Jean-Paul Sartre's most renowned biographer, Annie Cohen-Solal. Annie, you've started off by giving us a little bit of his milieu, that he was raised in this Protestant environment that's a minority tradition in France that very much focused on individuality, and this young genius who's nurtured as such by his mother and by his grandfather. He then goes off to school to be trained amongst the milieu of the École Normale Supérieure, the Ivy League school in France. Tell us a little bit about that experience. What is it like to be trained in that institution? Who were some of the people that he met there? How did this help shape him?
The École Normale Supérieure is very, very special. It's located, first of all, on the Montagne Sainte-Geneviève, you know, on a hill, near the Pantheon, you know, near the grands hommes, you know, the illustrious people from the French tradition. And you have to work extremely hard at a competition which takes 2 or 3 years after the baccalaureate. And among his peers, Sartre was very friendly with another brilliant writer called Paul Nizan, who's going to turn writer later on. All those were born in 1905. Another one, very famous politologist, political science professor, Raymond Aron. Another very, very great philosopher, Georges Canguilhem. And when I started my book, they were still alive, and I interviewed each single of them. And what they told me is that Sartre was absolutely over, beyond the whole group. First of all, because he was already a writer. He had published a novel. He had already published also an essay on cinema, because he was embracing the new emerging genres, which were not even legitimized by the academia. He was a great composer, because all the Schweitzer had the absolute pitch. So he was a playwright, and he was basically challenging authority. So the story goes that at the age of 20, 1925, he wrote a play for the end of school year party, and the play was taking after the title of Marcel Proust, A l'ombre des jeunes filles en fleurs, and his play was A l'ombre des jeunes billes en fleurs, so a little pastiche of that. And he not only wrote, he not only composed, but he also played, and the role he had was the role of making fun of the director of the École Normale Supérieure, who's called Gustave Lanson, who's not only was the director of this extraordinary school, but also the man who had created the the way French kids would learn from decades history of literature. The history of French literature by Gustave Lanson is the way everybody would learn literature. So Sartre, at the age of 20, took a mask and a hat and a little dog, and he was Gustave Lanson in the play. It's something that nobody else had ever dared doing before him. So you see, very early on, this man without a father, this little boy without a father, this little boy who engendered himself again through literature, would be a 20-year-old adolescent who would challenge the authority.
And
the same thing would be true in 1960 when he was challenged, Le Général de Gaulle, during the Algerian War. So basically, you see, step by step, Sartre having no fear in challenging authority when he felt it was right.
And now he's moved from being just homeschooled and being provided with this extraordinary education by his grandfather.
Privileged, yeah.
To being surrounded by what will become a generation of significant French intellectuals. One of them that he meets in these formative years is, of course, Simone de Beauvoir, who quickly became his lifelong companion. Their relationship was scandalous in its own time, and it seems to have become even more scandalous over time. Describe Sartre's relationship with Beauvoir and why it still continues to shock some people.
It was an odd pair. You know, she was an aristocrat. She was very beautiful. She was stronger than him in philosophy because she was more organized. And he was a short man, squinting, but with a lot of charm. And the first thing he told her was, "I am in love with you and I am a polygam. So we're going to write a contract that we will renew regularly." So the relationship was scandalous because that took place in 1929 in Paris, but then it took place in the provinces because he became a professor in Le Havre and she was a professor in Rouen. And not only was he exchanging with her, discussing philosophy, discussing literature, but he also discussing political ideas. But, you know, they created this very new model of recomposed families that at the time was completely unknown. So when Sartre was in love with his student, one of his students, Simone de Beauvoir would write a novel about it. They create a counter family made by, you know, younger people who would provide for Sartre and de Beauvoir a representation of life and who would be also used in a little production system as, for example, translating this piece by Sartre or playing the play by Simone de Beauvoir or going abroad and doing this and that. So it was what I called a very collective production system to develop this incredible engine that was Sartre's intelligence. And Simone de Beauvoir also was a diarist. So in her diaries that she kept all her life long, she describes their moves day by day, and actually in a way that I don't think is totally appropriate, because she really puts them under a we used to do this, we used to do that, and actually the things were much, much more complicated. So, you know, you see the young Sartre that I described at first, who was a subversive heir, you know, he was a privileged guy, but completely subversive. He applied his subversion to authority, but also to the way he led his affective life and his affection and, you know.
And so, to the sexual relationships that he has, and they share lovers, and she's bisexual, and this is part of what continues to scandalize, even as they recreate an alternative version of what the family can be. Each of them, of course, continues to write a great deal and begins to achieve some notoriety over the course of the period the French refer to as the Dark Years, the period under the Nazi occupation. And Sartre begins to achieve global fame in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. As existentialism itself comes to prominence, he articulating the axioms of existentialism, sometimes in dense philosophical tomes, and as you've been describing from the beginning, in plays, in public lectures, in the press, through the journal that he creates, L'État Moderne, named after the Charlie Chaplin movie, Modern Times, again indicating his appreciation for the newest art forms. He also spent time in the United States, as you've already referred to in this period. But today, sometimes, Sartre is cited as the quintessence of French anti-Americanism. Mm-hmm. You've tried to correct the record on this account. What did Sartre celebrate about America, and what did he critique about the United States beyond just its racism, which you've already pointed out?
This is a very good question and a very interesting one. I think that Sartre has been represented as the epitome of the anti-American intellectual, which I think is completely wrong. Sartre was in empathy with American values and American democratic values. And just to prove that, the only thing we need to do is to read his text about American cities, democracy in America. He understood the democratic values of the United States as a Protestant. He understood that the most important thing in this country is education. He wrote about American philanthropy. There's so many elements, micro elements, where you feel that he is completely in empathy with the country. What he did, though, is criticize and extremely harshly not only racism, but, you know, the country during the McCarthy era. He wrote a very strong text about the Rosenbergs in 1952. America has rabies. We should now leave it. If not, we're going to become mad for our own sake, you know. And another element he criticized was always the foreign policy of the United States. He was extremely active during the Vietnam War. He even created with Bertrand Russell this Russell Tribunal to institute himself as an authority, coming from what he called a void that nobody fills up and we have to fill in order to be on the side of the people of Vietnam, destroyed by the enormous American capitalist machine and imperialist machine. So we should not mix up everything, you know. Sartre's attitude towards American democratic values is absolutely clear. What he criticized was the imperialist side of American foreign policy. And even in 1965, he had agreed to go back to the United States and speak at Cornell University. He even prepared his lecture, but in the end, he decided not to go because he said, the United States is the most powerful country in the world, granted, but we don't have to consider it as the center of the world. The United States government would evolve better if we criticize it rather than if we praise it. And what he was criticizing is what Hubert Védrine, Minister of Foreign Affairs now in France, a few years ago in France, called hyperpower. And what Sartre always criticized was the ethnocentrism of the United States, you see? So I think that Sartre is someone who's extremely a visionary. Sartre has been criticized for so-called mistakes, you know, in politics, having sided for 4 years as a fellow traveler of the Communist Party, went to Moscow, said a few stupid things. But I think that Sartre, so early on, you know, I mean, predicted so early on the development of the changes of powers, the geopolitical changes of powers between Europe and the Third World, between the United States and Vietnam. He really was absolutely fascinated by those changes. And he indicated, I think I call him an ethical compass. You know, he indicated the changes which would appear 1 decade, 2 decades, 5 decades from the time he expressed his ideas. And they did appear. You know, I was so struck when a month ago, the French right-wing president, Nicolas Sarkozy, did an event at the Pantheon to celebrate Aimé Césaire, the poet from the West Indies, who became the mayor of Fort-de-France, who was a communist in the 50s, and who refused to welcome Sarkozy in Fort-de-France in 2005 because of a French law which said French professors of history should praise French colonization. So Aimé Césaire was absolutely furious and said, I'm not shaking hands with this Nicolas Sarkozy, who at the time was Minister of Interior. So Aimé Césaire passed away and Sarkozy decides to celebrate him in the Pantheon. And when I saw this ceremony, I felt, oh my God, you know, it is Sartre who in 1948 wrote a beautiful text called Black Orpheus to celebrate and to put on the scene, you know, to identify these African Americans or West Indies or African poets that nobody in France was looking at. So you see, like 60 years later, it's a right-wing president who doesn't even understand what he's saying and who hopes that the political writings of Césaire would disappear to the benefit of his poems, which is completely stupid. So Sartre's name was never pronounced, but nevertheless, he is the one who indicated the way that those guys were absolutely brilliant and completely invisible. That's a word he used, completely invisible for the Western world, for the Western, you know, white male who's, you know, completely ignoring them. So Sartre's life and Sartre's legacy has been to really always, in a very courageous way, striking the different oppressed categories of the population, which the French society or the American society was considering as marginal, peripheral, or invisible. He did the same thing with the Jews, you know, when he wrote Antisemite and the Jew. There's a lot to be said about this book, but nevertheless, he started with something called Portrait of the Antisemite, at a time where French people were completely embarrassed by the fact that half of the French population had collaborated with the Nazis, where it were the French police which gave the Jewish kids at the Vélodrome d'Hiver in July 1944 to the Nazis. So who had the courage to stand up and say, let's now talk about what is at stake here? And that thing, this is the very reason why the French still do not embrace Sartre the way Americans do. Because for the French, Sartre is too much of a subversive intellectual. Sartre is too much dealing with the French traumas of the collective memory. And France is a country with a long Catholic tradition. In the Catholic tradition, you do not talk about the secrets of the family. You don't talk about the taboos. You rather hide them and you put the rug on top of them. Sartre, with his Protestant ethics, his Protestant upbringing, is like Michel Rocard, another very important figure of French politics, who was completely put aside by Mitterrand, who was raised by the Jesuits. And there are, like that, a few brilliant characters in French society that the French have never really wanted to embrace because they were provoking and, you know, and threatening.
If you're just joining us, I'm Jonathan Judaikin and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm speaking about Jean-Paul Sartre with famed biographer Annie Cohen-Solal. And Annie, you've been pointing out how in a number of different circumstances, Sartre served as an ethical compass. And you specifically spoke about his putting onto the map in 1948 the negritude writers who were speaking out against colonialism, like Aimé Césaire. Sartre, of course, as you also said, was an advocate for the Soviet Union and for communism, at least from 52 to 56 and maybe for longer. But at the same time, he's serving in the context of the Cold War as a kind of ambassador to the Third World as it rises up against the colonial oppressors. And he did this, in fact, oftentimes by justifying the violent overthrow of the colonial system. And this is another case in which he's been derided, perhaps most viciously recently by Pascal Bruckner, whose book, The Tears of the White Man, Compassion as Contempt denounced Sartre's third worldism as a form of masochism and self-hatred. What would you say to those like Bruckner who claim that Sartre's radical politics was animated by self-loathing and a contempt for European society and Western civilization?
I've known Pascal Bruckner for many years, and I think it's a very bad book and very stupid polemic. I mean, the book has done no research at all. It's an attempt to destroy Sartre's project. I mean, I have nothing to say about that. I mean, honestly, what does it mean, masochism? I don't know what it means, self-hate. I don't know what it means. Honestly, I think this book is very poor. It's a book of an essayist in France. There are a lot of people who don't work much and think that with rhetoric, they're going to kill someone else. So it's a very French polemic, you know?
So then let's just say behind it, though, is the idea that sometimes by taking on the cause of others, one is engaged in a kind of self-critique. And certainly this notion of self-critique was intrinsic to Sartre's own way of thinking. So if it's not self-hatred, then what do you think was really behind Sartre's role as an advocate for decolonization around the world?
I must say that one thing which interested me a lot is discovering the way that Sartre behaved, not only in public life, you know, as a writer, as a lecturer, but in behaviors that were not supposed to be known. What he did, for example, for another young student, Jewish student, Robert Mizrahi, who came to see him in the Café de Flore in 1942. Mizrahi was wearing the yellow star as a Jew, and he told Sartre, "I admire your work." He had just read L'Etre et le Néant, Being and Nothingness, and he said, "But I will not be able to go on with my studies and the Agrégation de Philosophie because I don't have money and I'm a Jew." And Sartre said, "I will pay for the rest of your studies and I want you to get your exam." And Sartre did so. You know, I mean, there are many elements, many moments where you can see that he will completely engage himself for the other one. Another example, as a professor, all his students told me the way he used to teach. And one day in 1946, in a very interesting interview about Raymond Aron, I think he described the way he thinks that a teacher should behave. And I think that explains the whole thing. He said, "When I was a professor, I was not specially interested in the brightest students, but in the most curious ones, the ones who showed curiosity." He said, "Today at the university, there are many professors who are repeating the PhD they wrote once in their life, over and over again." And he said, "They are teaching and preaching the same way that during the old regime in France, you know, it was the aristocrats who were talking without anybody being able to dismiss what they were saying." And he added, "If the one who judges is not able to be judged by the other one, then there's no real democracy." So this is, for me, the core of Sartre's ethics. You see, he's the one who gives the other one, with a big O, other one, the ways to overcome the power game which is between them. I can tell you what happened when I went to see him. I was 20 years old. I was writing my MA on Paul Nizan. And I saw this man who really, I looked at him the way kids in France looked at their professor, which is like in awe. And he completely destroyed that hierarchy in front of me. First of all, he asked me who I was, where I came from, what I was thinking. And then he would answer not from the top to the bottom, but he would co-construct his speech with me. He would lead me to offer him a word and we would construct a truth together. It's something that I felt with nobody else before and afterwards, you know, how he would not use his symbolic power in order to crush me, but in order to empower me. So basically, Sartre is the one who is empowering the powerless. Because of self-hatred, this is stupid. I don't care. I noticed also, Jonathan, that when you taught Sartre, the critical of the dialectical reason, together with Bernasconi in Memphis, Tennessee, and you're humble enough not to tell it, you know, you empowered generations of young African Americans through teaching Sartre, right?
Well, I think that this is part of what scholars of Sartre and readers of Sartre find compelling, that you have someone who speaks oftentimes from a place of humility and comes from a place of generosity, but who can use the power of language in order to empower the powerless, as you said, and who thus became...
To let the powerless empower themselves, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And who thus became one of the great moralists of the 20th century. Aniko and Salal, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today on Counterpoint.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Aniko and Salal's biography of Sartre lifts the thinker from the written page and places him back into the principal dramas that defined the 20th century, exploring his consequence not only in his own time, but also for ours. Likewise, the Marcus Orr Center for the Humanities at University of Memphis is committed to shining a light on the academy, giving lie to the myth that the university is an ivory tower, and revealing instead its relevance to the big questions we face in our lives, personally, regionally, and nationally. Join us in this endeavor. Find us on Facebook or join us online at memphis.edu/MOCH for the Marcus Orr Center for the Humanities, where you can hear a podcast of this and other Counterpoint interviews. Counterpoint is a co-production of WKNO-FM and the Marcus W. Orr Center for the Humanities at University of Memphis. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.